In this news roundup of the week for 25th of November 2022. The EU and the US have a huge falling out over Biden's big subsidies for climate change action. China looks to be crossing the tipping point on its zero COVID policy as cases surge upwards. Does the virtue signalling around the World Cup prove Vladimir Putin right about the West growing intolerance? And in this week's Short Thought, why good quality thought benefits from the simple habit of being specific. My name's Malin Baker. This is The Malin Baker Show. The EU mobilised with urgency this week as the implications of the Biden administration's so-called Inflation Reduction Act, which was the name it gave its big climate bill, became increasingly clear. Specifically, the EU's gearing up to provide big subsidies for its own industries that deal with clean energy, alarmed by the major ones that Biden's bill makes available for US green industries. EU industry chief Thierry Breton warned that the subsidies posed an existential challenge to Europe's economy and, unless countered quickly, could lead to parts of the EU being left as an industrial wasteland as companies invested in preference in the United States. And it's just the latest instance. After the withdrawal from Afghanistan and for France over the US AUKUS alliance to sell submarines to Australia over its own, where the US has behaved in ways that the Europeans associated with Biden's predecessor. Apparently, some in the European leadership are now seeing Biden as someone who, quote, says the right things, but leaves you in the lurch when it counts. Website Politico put it this way: at each new perceived slight, the Europeans express shock, frustration, and dismay. How could Washington fail to consult its allies or at the very least inform them of its plans? Meanwhile, the American response is always some variant of, terribly sorry, we didn't think of that. One EU diplomat said that members of the EU were still hoping that Biden would send the IRA back to Congress for resizing. I mean, I know enough to know that's not happening. So there must be some desperate wishful thinking going on if people closer to the heart of the action are pinning their hopes on that. So what is being proposed as a response is an European sovereignty fund, which would help businesses investing in Europe to meet green standards. The belief is that rapid action's needed as companies are currently making decisions about where to build future factories for goods and services such as batteries, electric cars, wind turbines and microchips. According again to Politico, they're also keen to act quickly to prevent individual EU members from breaking ranks and creating their own emergency funds. Crisis situations from the pandemic to the energy crisis have seen less than stellar unity between individual countries, a tendency that probably really is an existential threat to the EU's vision for its future role and existence. Brussels particularly sees the Biden bill's blatantly protectionist encouragement for consumers to buy American when it comes to electric vehicles as being an attack on global free trade. This week, Germany and France, who have been seriously in dispute with each other over a range of issues, put those differences to one side to support action to counter Americans' position, talking about the risk of a transatlantic trade war. But the challenge is that the EU is not well placed to respond anyway at the scale that would really matter. For one thing, regardless of its sense of urgency, it will move more slowly than would be ideal since all 27 EU countries have to agree to it. Even assuming that happens, EU members will find it hard to get anything like the same scale of funding into it as the billions upon billions of dollars that Washington's throwing at the agenda. Given the energy price crisis and associated economic knock-on effects in Europe, they will really struggle. The realisation that they're only slowly digesting, reportedly, is that the Trump administration was not the one-off aberration they fought, regardless of Biden's announcement that America was back. It was instead the beginning of an extended period where the US switched from championing free trade to instead retreating into protectionism. Indeed, when challenged about the impact of the IRA bill, the US trade ambassador told the Europeans to introduce their own subsidies, as one observer put it, to join the China train. A clear sign that a new world order is in the offing is when the old players start to adjust the rules to match the new players, rather than the other way round. But what about the new world of solidarity in the face of Putin's war in Ukraine? Well, solidarity seems available on a now-you-see-it-now-you-don't basis. And it's a game that others can play, as the UK has discovered. So Belgium has blocked the export of technology critical for its NATO ally Britain's nuclear deterrent. The UK has now threatened to cancel an arms order worth up to 600 million euros unless that export is authorised. The export for a specialised isostatic press was vetoed by the Ecolo Green Party, which is part of a rather delicately held together governing coalition. Previously, the export licence had been treated as a formality, but it turns out that the Ecolo Party's Deputy Prime Minister, Georges Gilquinet, is generally opposed to the arms trade. Now, the fact this had even happened had been classified as a Belgian defence secret, but that wasn't going to hold given the consequences. The leak of the situation to a Belgian broadcaster has created a political backlash that could even bring down the coalition government. President of the Liberal MR Party, Georges-Louis Boucher, said, "Refusing the sale of equipment to Great Britain is the greatest of dogmatic stupidity." And Christian Democrat Georges Dalamain, because all politicians in Belgium are called Georges, apparently, said, "This is all the more outrageous given the UK's consistent military involvement in NATO and in particular in the Ukrainian conflict, where we should be following the example of our British allies." I expect the US would point to that and say, "You should be a little bit more mindful of your own issues," before casting aspersions across the Atlantic. Still, how different would the relationship be if the next president of the United States was, you know, Kanye West, who declared his candidacy today? Well, we're probably not going to find out, although the candidacy could be a good thing. If he can mount a serious threat of splitting the crazy vote, maybe both of the parties will respond by nominating serious, non-crazy candidates. I know, idle fantasies, but we can but hope. No such issues in China, where they apparently now have a leader for life, which they may come to regret. So, for instance, it really is starting to look like Xi Jinping's zero COVID policy is right on the verge of what always seemed like inevitable failure. The country has reported its highest daily number of COVID infections since the pandemic started, regardless of its strict lockdowns and its mass testing. 31,000 infections were reported overnight, and that may well be higher because there's been clear indications of underreporting at times in the past, so we just don't know the real figures. This was always the most likely final conclusion, given what we've seen in practice in the rest of the world with the high degree of transmissibility of the Omicron variant. The growth in infection rates comes at the same time as an exhausted population is becoming increasingly restive in the face of lockdowns and various other measures. There was literally a riot of workers this week at the world's biggest iPhone factory in Zhengzhou, which has been declared a five-day lockdown zone to start today. Footage that made it onto Twitter showed guards in full body protective suits, some of whom seemed to be kicking protesters who were on the ground. This came after thousands of workers had fled the factory last month in the fear that a lockdown was about to be imposed that would trap them on site. New workers were brought in to replace them, but they quickly found that things they had been promised, money that they had been promised specifically, were not in their contract. Also, they were scared that exposure to the existing workforce made it more likely that they in turn would contract COVID themselves, hence the riots. Why does China persist in a policy that just about all outside observers have agreed from the start is doomed to failure? Well, as we've said before, partly because Xi Jinping pinned so much of his personal authority onto it, and that of course, is one of the big failings of an autocratic state. There are so few mechanisms for self-correction, particularly for delusionary impulses that start at the top. And partly because the Chinese population remains potentially vulnerable. I mean, they had the benefit that in 2.5 years they fended it off. It evolved into Omicron, the less deadly variant. But China still has only 40% of its most vulnerable people, the over 80-year-olds, vaccinated. And also the country has a chronic lack of intensive care beds for whatever reason. You might say you would have presumed that an autocratic country with a stated political communist spirit would have been one of the leaders in doing those things. After all, if you can force millions of people to shut themselves in their rooms, presumably you can force them to be vaccinated. And yet, that hasn't happened. Perhaps because it's widely acknowledged that the Chinese vaccine is less effective, but national pride prohibits that from being acknowledged, even while it might reduce the sense that a major vaccination push is worth it. Beijing acknowledged the first deaths from COVID this week for 6 months. Now, the numbers there are still tiny compared to other countries, even if you take into account likely underreporting. What we don't know is how many deaths are happening because of the zero COVID policy rather than because of COVID itself. Individual stories come out, such as the man who lived 5 minutes away from a hospital who could not get an ambulance while he was having a heart attack, and the 3-year-old boy who died of gas poisoning in a lockdown compound, and a 4-month-old baby who died after a 12-hour delay in medical response in a quarantined hotel. But as we all know, this thing is not going away. So keeping people away from it while not vaccinating them, at a massive cost to the economy and the well-being of the people who are repeatedly being locked up, well, it's hard to see a scenario where that ends well. Bear in mind that most Chinese citizens are not exposed to news about how this has been playing out in the wider world. So social media has been seeing incredulity from Chinese football fans as they watch the World Cup. And they see crowds of unmasked people from around the world all together in the stadiums. The Times of London quoted one Chinese blogger who wrote this: "The Qatar World Cup has opened and we haven't seen the fans wearing masks there, and we haven't heard reports that they must provide negative PCR test results." That blogger's site, you know what's coming, was subsequently shut down. Well, at least censorship is still something the Chinese government continues to do better than anyone else. So that's something, I suppose. Still, at least their broadcasters will have been focusing on the football, not indulging in long speeches about morality and rights and stuff. I was brought up to think about football as an event where 22 grown men kick a bag of windabout. And yes, I know you could come up with an equally disparaging description for tennis, which I do like. Anyway, the point is, I have no interest in the World Cup as a sporting event. But what has been fascinating is how the world seems to be becoming incapable of hosting international sports events that don't become intensely politicised. And yes, specifically by the West. And this is something of a change. It used to be the line that sports was a meeting point for cultures and nationalities. We put aside our often deep differences and celebrate our love of the competition. And that's the benefit of it, the single piece of common ground the whole world could look to. That was before the virtue signalling became an apparently essential part of team sports, as it now has become. Of course, there's always been isolated protests about some issue or another, but they were usually outside the central narrative of the event. The problem with this World Cup started with the fact that it's hosted by Qatar, and the decision to host it seems unquestionably to have been arrived at by pretty blatant bribery and corruption. A country that had no infrastructure and a hostile climate but lots of money won the right to host the event. It then mobilised badly paid foreign workers to build the venue in the most appalling conditions, and the world then turned up to play football there. Now, that's not pretty to look at. There is no doubt that investigative journalism should have been looking into how all of that happened. However, the thing that people have really spent the most time on is the fact that Qatar, in common with a number of Muslim-majority countries, does not share Western attitudes towards LGBT people and issues. And so teams wanted to wear their rainbow One Love armbands, because even though the culture of the sport is such that there are almost no out active footballers, they're still deeply empathetic to those communities, so they say. And when FIFA said, no, we don't want political slogans on show, then we saw protests such as the Germany team posing for the pre-match photo with their hands over their mouths to let you know they'd been silenced. Others were offended by the fact that Qatar's wealth is based on a history of fossil fuel supply, so its claim to have made the games carbon neutral were attacked during the sports programmes broadcast by the BBC. And that itself faced criticism from MPs for one-sided and unbalanced reporting. When a climate broadcaster, James Stewart, presented his view of the catastrophic impact of CO2 produced by such events, then climate activist Mike Berners-Lee claimed that the World Cup was, quote, the highest carbon event of any kind apart from a war that humans have ever staged. No supporting evidence or argument for that fairly bold claim was given. And another activist scientist, Kevin Anderson, associated with the extreme apocalyptic end of the discourse, said, we need to send a message to FIFA that we are not prepared to sacrifice the well-being of our own children. So we slipped seamlessly from 22 men kicking a bag of wind about to literal genocide. Good times. Why does this matter? Simply because the people involved, as always with ideologues, are blind to the unintended consequences of their actions. So, do I think it's bad that LGBT people are not legally allowed to admit their existence in Qatar? Sure. I mean, I'm a product of my country. I believe in equal rights for everybody. Do I believe more strongly in that today than people believed in their essential differences with each other 30 years ago, when politics was kept out of international sport? No, of course not. The nations of the world have always had visceral differences in their viewpoint, then as now. Some of those issues have changed. You know, the way we think has evolved. The fact of disagreement has not. So the thing that has changed is the willingness of Western countries, as represented by their athletes, their broadcasters, their governments, to tolerate the existence anywhere in the world of substantive differences to their own perspective. Not that those differences get ignored in the political sphere, mind. I mean, they never have been. And I would want my government to speak out about human rights abuses, while, you know, preferably not taking actions itself that would make it a hypocrite on those topics. But we're now saying that we can't put the politics to one side ever. Whatever the activity, we have to at least wear a badge insulting the deeply held beliefs of the country that we're in. Because obviously it's self-evident that we are right about everything. Self-evident that we should be giving children puberty blockers, and that's a good thing, while nevertheless protesting Qatar's position that makes illegal sex outside of traditional marriage bad thing. You find this position immoral and unnatural? Well, we will call you a bigot and insist that you change to fit our perspective, or else we will punish you. Whether it's sport, whether it's trade, whether it's aid, there is now one way, and it's our way. Again, I'm not saying other cultures are beyond criticism. They're not. Not the culture in Qatar, and not the culture in Great Britain, and not the culture in the United States. But what's new is the idea that we won't show you respect, even in a sporting context, if you transgress our values. We have become so arrogant that we no longer look at the world and see different perspectives and other cultures that we should aim to understand and tolerate. We just see right and wrong. And by sheer lucky accident, we're right and you're wrong. Well, them's the breaks. One journalist has said that in private conversations with the Qataris, they now regret hosting the World Cup because of the constant negative publicity. If most of that publicity had been about how the event was secured and how the stadium was built, that would be fair justice. Because bribery and corruption and basic human rights of workers, those are designated and agreed as universal principles. basic human rights, signed up to as basic declarations by all the members of the United Nations. Whatever you think of the institution of the UN, it means the whole world agrees that those principles matter. There's no cultural exceptions on that score. Even cultures where bribery is endemic kind of understand it shouldn't be, and that it isn't acceptable in a global context specifically. But most of it has been about the fact that Qatar's national culture is antipathetic to the culture of the West, particularly the left-wing, wokist left that dominates the media. By teaching all such countries, and the same principles apply to most African countries and a number of Asian ones, that they dare not host events that will draw the attention of the West to them. Those arguing for an alternative world order, one that stands in opposition to the West, they gain a huge degree of high-profile affirmation. So yes, when Vladimir Putin says the West wants to dominate you and force you to accept things you currently abhor, he can point at this, and they will nod along in recognition. Great job, everybody. As far as I can see, there is one habit that separates thinking and useful truth-seeking from just venting, expressing emotional conviction based on your identity. And that one specific habit is the habit of being specific. I see constantly in the discourse on social media, including in comments on these videos, sweeping comments that say things like, "We were told X." X is usually some extreme extrapolation on an issue, and my immediate instinctive response to such a statement is to ask the question, well, told by who exactly? In these polarised times, what we love to do is group everyone who's not like us into a homogenous unit and attribute the dumbest or the most extreme sentiment made by a minority of them onto all of them. Most issues are nuanced. Rarely, if ever, do you find extended groups of people who are all malevolent, lying and or stupid, any more than you would find them being angels. So the simple fact of being specific helps you to understand the world and probably stay out of quite so many trench warfare situations, which I would argue is a good thing. You might not agree. If you can't do that, you will be constantly befuddled when events go on that seem to you to be incomprehensible as to why they would happen. Like the man who attacked me recently on Twitter for having said, in passing, making a different point, that Sweden didn't lock down. More lies, he said. Not sure what he thought the previous lies were, because we hadn't had any sort of previous exchange that I'm aware of. Sweden had the strictest lockdown policy in Europe. After initially not implanting the policy, it was a major embarrassing failure. Strictest lockdown policy in Europe? I mean, really? That's the first time I've ever heard anyone say that. In all the heated arguments about what Sweden did or didn't mean to lockdown policy, about which we've all heard plenty, this was a new line for me. And then you can look at it specifically. Clamping down hard involved specifically restricting the number of people in shops, businesses and public places. For example, groups of no more than eight in restaurants. Well, in the UK, we were told stay home. You were not allowed to meet anyone outside your household. Only essential workers could go to work. Restaurants, gyms, pubs, non-essential shops closed. You could go out alone or with household members to do one session of exercise per day, although they did admit later it didn't really matter if you exercised more than once. I mean, we all lived through this, right? We were there. Only one of those seems to me to be a description of what you would describe as a lockdown. But when you have a strong position and you deal with generalities only, then over time your understanding of, even your memory of, what you're discussing changes to become more and more black and white in favour of your position. And we can expect more of this, because I think it's really started to sink into a wider group of people now that the heat of the moment has passed, that we're seeing some real negative consequences from the COVID policies that were followed, and that you probably need to follow a policy that's focused on a full picture approach to harm reduction, not focusing singly on just one cause of death. And that's forcing a certain amount of history rewriting prompted by cognitive dissonance. And I've seen people say, well, before you're even allowed to have that discussion, we want an apology for having been dismissed as arguing that people can die and all of the rest of what was thrown around. And I've seen the same said in relation to other issues, such as the fact that the New York Times and The Guardian this week both ran pieces starting to ask the question, well, why are so many girls presenting as transgender all of a sudden? Could there be just a smidgen of social contagion? Are puberty blockers really a great idea for underage people? Just raising the question. But of course, people have been banned from Twitter, have been labelled as bigots and all sorts for just asking that question. And yes, some people, for instance, do probably owe Abigail Schreier an apology. But practically speaking, you slow down the resolution of an issue by demanding surrender on the part of everyone on the other side, most of whom never said the things that you remember most vividly. Because, of course, there has been nuance in these discussions. Many people saying, we don't know, while all the attention is taken by political figures who unwisely suggest that we do. We should make ourselves suffer twice on all this. First, by taking complex common problems and turning them into a team sport, polarised into opposite extremes, and then compounding that by insisting on the surrender of the other side before we can turn it into something sensible. Getting the right answer is more important than your team scoring a few political points. All right. Next week, I am actually involved with something in the second half of the week. That will mean that Friday's roundup will probably be a little less up-to-the-minute topical in what it covers. It'll definitely be going out. I haven't missed a Friday since I started doing these, but it will be focused on big issue dynamics more than the most up-to-date details. Hopefully, all the big news will happen in the first half of the week next week. For now, let me thank those who support this channel on Patreon. You know the score. I simply could not get the time to produce these videos without that support. If you would like to add yours for the independent, fact-focused and non-ideological content I aim to produce here, please head on over to patreon.com/Malin Baker. It is always appreciated. Either way, have a great week. My name is Malin Baker. This is the Malin Baker Show. Thanks for watching this video. If you liked it, please share with anyone else you think would also enjoy it. Word of mouth is really important to us. And if you've not subscribed yet, what are you waiting for? As the saying goes, that subscribe button won't smash itself.